Hello, My Little Abercrombians. So we're still working with the format, and I think we're switching to officially, for at least the next several episodes, three chapters a week. And this week, in the following episode, we will be covering Chapter 10, The Good Man, Chapter 11, On the List, and Chapter 12, An Offer and a Gift. All right, guys, let's get into it. Hey, everybody.
Excuse me.
Hi. Okay. Welcome to the very second First Law cast. My name is Gus Storms, and these are my co-hosts, Ian Bertram.
Hey.
And Peter Schmidt.
Hey, what's up, everybody? How you all doing? It's a Wednesday over here. I feel like that's new and exciting. We usually do this on a Monday.
In this podcast, we will be examining the ins and outs of Joe Abercrombie's First Law trilogy, including peripheral novels and short stories, moving chapter by chapter through the works of our grimdark master. Guys, welcome back. This is our second episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm excited to be here. You know, second is best. That's what they always say. The third one? Gonna get rich.
They do always say that. I'll also note we'll be giving proper recognition to the audiobook versions of these works, primarily read by the great Stephen Pacey. These books are incredible reads off the page and only made better by Pacey's performance. So if you're reading or listening along, I recommend the purchase of both versions.
And if you want to send us a impression of Pacey doing a character, we'd love that. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite, he's coming up. It's Ladislar. Is my favorite Pacey of all time. We've gotten little glimpses of him, but anyway,
oh, I yes. love Ladislar.
Ugh. I don't even know who that is.
Yeah,
because I haven't read these books before.
We did talk about him a little bit last episode, but
yeah. Yeah, he's the prince.
Yeah. The he shows up for like 1 second.
Just
well,
one second. Yeah,
I'm very excited about this because I've never read these books before.
That's true.
So we're going to endeavor upon a sort of watch-along style podcast, but it's a read-along. We will be starting with Abercrombie's first book in the First Law trilogy, The Blade Itself. Last week, we did chapters 0, or the prologue, through 9, and now we're moving on through 10 through 14. Right, guys?
Yes.
That's right. 10 through 14. Oh, boy. And some good stuff happens in these chapters. Oh, my. Oh my,
I mean,
oh
they
my.
Are, yeah, they're full of some good content. Peter, do you want to do a little summary, if you can, of what we're working on with the from last episode?
Gus, my friend, I would love to on this Wednesday afternoon, evening. It's 9:30. So last time, we've basically been reading three characters, three POV characters jumping back and forth. The first one, Logan the Nine, has been lost. And found his way to Baez, the first of the Magi's house, where he ran into the King of the North's son. What's the name? Calder?
Calder.
Who basically said to Baez, the first of the Magi, this great, powerful wizard dude, who we don't know really what the scope of his powers are, that, hey, you got to hang out with my dad. And Baez is like, your dad wants to hang out. He's got to come to my house. And that's kind of where we ended with Logan the Nine. But then Jazael, my boy, the other POV character, he's getting ready for this contest thing. He's been training with the sword, but he hates it because my boy just likes to rest. He just likes to drink. He just likes to fuck. He doesn't want to be bothered with this contest thing. But he's also been seeing this Artie, who is Major West, his superior officer's sister, which is a little complicated. It's a little spicy. Yeah.
Super spicy.
That's basically it. And then we get Inquisitor Glockta. So,
yes. Yeah, Ian, you want to tell us about Glockta? One?
Yeah, so Glockta's a little complicated, but basically he is been put in charge of dealing with the Mercer Guild. And we're not entirely sure if the Mercer Guild is actually trying to defraud the king or if it's a plot by Archlector Salt to make it look that way. So that's where we're at. With
sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been given like a special role like above all of the other inquisitors,
yeah,
where he reports
inquisitor obscura or
exempt.
That's right.
So he's doing private work for the inquisitor. Who knows?
And at no point does he think he will not be murdered by his superiors. Yeah. And it's very complicated. He's got his practicals being sort of the
the grunts of the inquisitorial cast. It's
the grunts and thugs, it feels like. They're not just like the low ranking inquisitors. They're also the people that put black bags over people's heads and break their fingers. You know, you got to go to trade school before you can, you know, like start chopping off teeth and stuff.
So, yeah, then we jump into chapter 10, where we are in an open audience with Lord Chamberlain Hoff, who is the creature who vets audiences with the king.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Like this, this seems like an official government meeting, but it's actually just to see what stuff will actually be put in front of the small council, the open council, the next day. And this guy is drinking, doesn't like his job, the room is too hot. And we're seeing all this through the eyes of Major West, who...
Right, we get our first new POV character here.
We met him
previously. He is the kind of friend of Giselle, although maybe not. And the brother of Artie West, who is the twinkle in Giselle's eye.
Boyfriend, girlfriend. They're boyfriend, girlfriend now.
Well, no, they're not.
Well, they held hands. So.
Well, they held hands, so technically...
I mean, that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
So when we get Goodman Heath, who wanders in there hat in hand. And he's looking for an audience with the king, which is ridiculous.
This guy's got no chance. He looks like an idiot. He rode a month to get here. Oh my gosh. And what's the deal with him? The landlord kicked him off because the landlord says he didn't pay rent, but Heath says
they live in a capitalist society.
Get the fuck out of here.
It's not capitalist, it's feudal.
A capitalist feudal society.
There is no recourse for
becoming a capitalist society slowly.
But we get Goodman Heath is he's the shitbag. He's the one who was just trod upon and he gets dismissed summarily.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Get the fuck out of here, you farmer piece of shit. What are you doing
here?
I almost did, but I decided not to. But then you brought it back. Anyway, I'm Hoff right now. Bring in the next motherfucker. And they do. And the next motherfucker is he's a magistrate for the Guild of Mercers, which is interesting because the Guild of Mercers have totally been targeted by the Inquisition and are continuing to be targeted by them. And they're coming in here to complain about this shit. But what are they going to find any sympathy from Hoff? No. This guy.
Well, I don't know. Well, he is drunk. Is that their complaint entirely that they're being targeted by the Inquisition? I don't know.
Yeah, totally. That's why he wants to get the audience with the king. He says that their sterling reputation has been tarnished.
Yeah, there's some plot to undermine our honorable guild.
Yes.
Okay.
And Hoff though, you know, shares sentiment with Archlector Salt and that like y'all are a bunch of upstart merchants with no royal blood. Like what the hell do you think you're getting here? You already have all these riches and things. You think you're better than a bunch of the nobles. Get the fuck out of here. Like the disdain is equal to that of Goodman Heath, but Hoff just has a lot more fun doing it.
No. And that is sort of a pleasure is he's equivalently hateful of both of these creatures. Neither of them are noble blood. Neither of them have any right talking to the king or even him.
Exactly.
Totally. Fun. But
it is fun.
But Heath is like not Heath.
Oh, we didn't actually say his name. It's Dan Colt, Magister Coaster Dan Colt. I'll learn how to do the names eventually.
Magistrate Colt. Yeah. You know, he is cool looking. He's big and fat and in gold and purple brocade.
Yeah. Like seems fancy, but this guy's a commoner. Get out of those fancy clothes, buddy.
Yeah, but they got more money than everything.
Yeah. Money can't buy you happiness, dude. That's what the nobles always say. That's you know, that's the fact of the matter.
That's how they keep you down, man.
That is how they keep you down.
We do hear a little bit for the first time of many in these chapters about Styria.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Who brings it up? I don't know what that means. I don't know.
Colt does. It's Styria. They have Styria's a different continent where they have an outpost called Westport. We'll talk a little bit more about that later.
He mentions fuck these Westport boys, right? Like,
yes,
is Westport. So Styria is like another continent or something?
It is. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
And the Styrians come back around in this book in a fun way.
We get a lot of talk hysteria here too.
And then we get the drum roll, the big bad.
The big bad.
The big old guy. Yeah. It was
so we get White Eye Hansel and two other guys, and then this gigantic hulking behemoth who has to duck under a 7-foot feeling or I love this part.
I loved that their descriptions, like their weapons were all taken from them, but they're still wearing this battered armor. They just look like warriors with this great beards, and then this massive figure steps in and you could see all the air sucked out of the room. Major West, who we feel is an extremely competent, cold with sweat, terrified in this hot room of this giant, even though he's got no weapons, nothing of the sort, right?
Right.
Right. And that comes back a little more later, but the giant is totally cloaked. Like, we don't see really anything about him. Mm-hmm. He is cowled fully. And White-Eyed Hansel, who is... I guess, awesome. I mean,
one of the best voices.
But does he come back, Ian? Do you know?
He does. He does come back.
Okay.
Third book.
I don't remember him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, fuck.
I
mean,
I love him. He's great. So well, because we've got this giant, but then like White-Eye Hansel, he just speaks like, well, what is the answer? Like, I am here to, I can't even do it. It's the most beautiful thing. Like,
I am here on behalf of Bethod.
And Hoff, who's hated everybody, loves this guy. He's like, whoa, this is a northerner with manners.
Oh, he's having a good time. I mean, Hoff, it must be said, is a great character.
Yeah, that's right. Because when they first show up, he's like, his undersecretary says, there's some Northmen outside. And Hoff is like, well, they can't be trusted, can they? The savages.
Oh my God, you're right. He does say that. And then they like, all they do is the most base level of like propriety shit, like bowing and being like,
it's and then he's like, and then he's like, Moro, you led me astray. You told me they were savages.
Exactly. I love them though. They're being nice to me. They're not upstarts. And basically they say they have a gift. They have a gift. They want peace everlasting with the Union. They're bringing a gift. And Hoff just
tomorrow to for the open council where they will get audience with the king in the open council, which is, as I said last time, I think that is the Congress.
Yeah,
there is the king, the closed council, and the open council. And the open council is sort of big, and it's nobles and subsidiary nobles from all different colonies. So yeah, he gets brought in, and everyone's shitting their pants. There is some
except like, for Hoff. Because he's
except for Hoff, because he's so drunk, which is so good.
Yes,
he never really gets flustered.
No, I love it.
And then
I think they even say like
Gus.
Major...
I think this is one of your favorite characters. We get Peter. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I love that. I love that Major West is like almost impressed with Hoff for a second when Hoff is like, "What is this big man? Who? What are you doing in my house? Oh, a gift.
He talks about like."
Cool.
The psychic pall that drops over everybody, and everyone's sort of shuddering and confused by. They do say his name, Fenris the Feared. Like they name him here. Nobody can even stand up in front of him except for Hoff, who's just this bloated, drunk asshole.
Right. It's amazing. So they offer a gift for the king and open council the next day, and Hoff says, "This is great. Come on in." Which is kind of wild. Enthused. You get the feeling that people don't really go get to see the king. I think even when we go to the open council later, it's like, this is the only thing they're doing other than like basic stuff. Anyway,
right.
We'll get there though. But yeah, then the last person on the list comes in, right? And described to Hoff as a mage. And Hoff just thinks this is going to be the most fun ever. It's a way to, it's the last person of the day and this person's going to make a fool of themselves and get
fully giddy.
Absolutely.
So in walks Yuru Sulphur, who is an amazing, amazing character. But he's sort of like, you know, confident, a little laid back. He goes up to Hoff and basically says, you know, I'm here on behalf of Baez. And Hoff says to him...
Let's just talk about Sulphur's appearance for a second. I mean,
So he's got two different colored eyes.
Yeah, two different colored eyes. They don't exactly know where he's from.
Well, that's a little bit of race science on behalf of West. He gets into that immediately. West is like, okay, geographically based on this, where is he from? That old English tradition, little race science,
figure it out though, which is interesting because it seems like West is good at that kind of stuff.
Well, it's also just funny. I mean, like a person who walks in who isn't like pale white, and West is like, interesting.
Yeah.
Where is this human being from? Based on his skin color. Like he goes into
It's a whole tight thing. Curls. His skin is too light to be from Gurkul or whatever.
I think West is a white supremacist.
I think that they all are.
Well, yeah.
I mean, this is like colonial Britain era, so they're all fuckers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They are all fuckers. I can sense that on them.
But Eurosilfer knows some shit.
Oh, yeah. He comes in and like immediately Hoff is ready to just throw this guy down the well, see him like fuck up and do something bad, and then probably throw him in jail and get him tortured, right? Like, he describes the other mages that he's seen as being like it actually insane or just world-class swindlers. But Eurosilfer has the has whatever it is, like a note or something that proves he's genuine. And Hoff suddenly goes white-faced and is like, this is a big deal, what you have here. We'll have to talk about this in a closed council.
Hoff does like a bit of a feigned disbelief, and then Sulfur presents bona fides and Hoff just goes white.
Yeah.
And doesn't know Feecht is gone.
Oh, Sulfur doesn't.
Right.
That's who Sulfur wanted to talk to specifically.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a weird bit of writing. So he doesn't know that the person they're there for doesn't exist anymore, but he can read Wes' mind.
Cool. Yeah. No, I definitely picked that up. I was definitely like, oh, can he read? He can read. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Because the magic in this has so far been really subtle, other than when Logan summoned the spirits and they were full of shit. And then he sucked one into his mouth and burned a guy with it. Like, other than that, it's all been pretty low key. But yeah, I picked up on that. Reading minds and being weird and living in a house on the Agrion somewhere in there. This guy is.
So Wes leaves the audience and he's fucked up. Because Chamberlain Hoff told all of the people to shut their mouths, never come back.
Yeah, and he's also thinking about Artie and the war that might happen and just sort of general unease at everything. And then he runs into Goodman Heath, who's sitting outside.
The farmer boy.
Basically, he offers him like an empty promise.
The farmer man.
The farmer man, sorry. The farmer man. He offers him an empty promise.
Yes. Yeah. He basically says, and I love that too. It's like something that happens a few times, but both characters know that it's an impossible thing. Like, they're both lying to each other, but it's just it's the courteous thing to do. So Wes says, oh, I know someone who can maybe help you out. Goodman Heath knows that's impossible. And then Wes gives him some money and then walks away. And that's how that chapter ends. And then we get to chapter 11.
I do like the save the cat moment with West, where he can't deal with enjoying what he did. He just is ashamed that he had to give him money and then run away.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. 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 That was a really good moment.
One of the reasons why West is such a great character. I mean, you said it a little problematic, but like, I mean, he's doing this out of the kindness of his heart, but he also knows it's useless. And he's up against this gigantic machine that will like churn Goodman Heath out no matter what he does. So he gives him this money, but he knows it's an impossible thing for him to do anything good with it. And it's
he's a commoner. I think it really comes down to him being a commoner because Giselle and Glockta have this like real arrogant like shittiness about them. But like Major West, the people he likes to see like kind of get their commitments, at least that we've seen so far, are usually like rich boys. Like Major West likes Giselle, but also likes seeing Giselle get beaten up by Varus, So it makes sense that he would step out and actually empathize with the poor farmer. I mean, I think because this is a POV chapter, even when they're in there, he's sympathizing with the farmer the whole time. Like that we were kind of led to that sort of place. I'm really excited to see what is going on with this mage, though. I mean, to see Hoff suddenly sober up and call a closed council like that, tell everybody, like, if anybody says anything about what happened here, when we know no information, basically. We just know that this guy gave Hoff a letter, and now if anybody says that this guy showed up, they're going to get in huge trouble, is pretty awesome. Exciting, especially coming after the Guild of Mercers guy, who seemed like that would be a big moment, and it totally wasn't, and the delegation from King Bethod in the north also. I don't know. It's setting up a lot of stuff. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, you're right. Structurally, it's a great chapter. Like, we see everyone come, like, we see a cross-section of humanity come in front of Hoff.
Oh, for sure.
And he's completely dissatisfied and uninterested or impressed with any of them. Even the most terrifying of them, like Fenris the Feared. And then we get a guy who walks in who's, like, nonchalant, and he gives him some papers, and Hoff is like, like, what can this be? You know, like, that's a great writing. I was like,
he finds some profound amusement at the hands of the North people. Like, he's delighted by that.
It also is interesting because we've gotten a big sort of mixture of responses to the mages so far. You know, they seem like most people think they're kind of ridiculous or relics of the past. And we see both sides of that in Hoff right here. And I guess I just really appreciated how how thoroughly his mind was changed.
It's your evil past coming back to roost.
Like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm. All right. So
chapter 11,
right into the mic. We're on the hunt for Villa Dan Rob. Villain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan Rob. This is a pretty quick chapter, all things considered.
Basically, after last time, you know, Glockta's looking for these people that are doctored up on this list to fuck over the...
Right.
It's the Ruse's Guild list. Of Mercers.
Yes.
Yeah, Ruse's list to fuck up the Guild of Mercers for the Archlector. And we find them in the middle of trying to black bag somebody, like inside the house with Glockta comically trying to stealthily walk up some stairs.
I mean, it's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I think it feels like absurd that he's there while this is happening because like Practical Frost and Severard are also there. Well,
he should not be.
Yeah. Why is he there? It's almost like a D&D campaign thing where you have like two rogues who are going in to sneak in. It's like, well, let's bring the wizard just because he'll be bored if we.
Well, I think you got a warrior and a rogue, or a berserker and a rogue. And
sure. But the point is, like, just leave the wizard out of it. But they'll be bored at the table, so you better bring them. It just feels like one of those kinds of situations,
right?
But luckily, the stealth doesn't matter very long, right? Because
his fucking head has been cut off.
Yeah. Yeah. And we get I love that bit of Frost humor.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah. I was gonna say yeah. No, go. It's great.
Well, it's just so funny. He's like poisoned.
Right. So they get into the study and there's like blood everywhere, papers strewn everywhere. This guy's neck is like hacked, cut to the point of like being held on by a string. Yeah. And Glockta says like, how was he killed? And there's a long pause. Right. And Frost goes, poisoned. Yeah. It's funny. I laughed.
It's good. It's very funny.
And what Glockta says like, yes, apparently, like something like that.
And then he sort of teases out that whole pantomime of a poisoner.
I mean, it really feels like a joke you would have at the time. So this looks like at first glance, like some just like, you know, botched burglary from like some fucker. But Glockta's looking around and he basically.
No footprints in the blood. Like, obviously somebody did it to make it look botched. And then it.
Yeah. Yeah. They had looked around through all of the papers and materials at some point. It was a professional hit, which is a little curious considering that this person.
Inauspicious.
He was on a list to be gathered by the Inquisition. This feels like it's maybe a little weird, right?
Targeted.
Right?
Yeah. And our intrepid gang goes to a different house and
same shit.
Looks like the list's been compromised, guys. That list that was written up by Ruse with Glockta, that who else saw it? Archlector Salt and that superior dude, Kaelin?
Kaelin,
who was like, you know what? Let's let the Mercers have a break. Why don't you give me some gold and we'll just chill the fuck out about it. Guys.
Well, and then accepted the bribe and then ratted him out.
Yeah. 100%. Yep. He accepted the bribe and then ratted him out.
And then we get Glockta sitting on a bench. And he's just feeling sad because he's Glockta.
Oh, I love the park scene. It's hard to be Glockta. The park scene is so good.
And he's just sitting there just being disgusting.
Like the drunk soldiers fucking around on a boat.
Yeah.
Yep.
And people making out and nobody wants to sit by him because why would they?
Yeah. Just the saddest boy in the world.
Yeah. He's really, really lonely sitting out here. And I started getting to the point of being like, why is he doing this to himself? Like what? The place is full of people. And he has like a lot of room around him. And even says like people walk up excited to find a free space, look at him and go, oh, let's go somewhere else. Let's get out of here.
Ew, gross.
Yeah, he must be. Yeah, that fucking gross. Yeah. I mean,
he
I guess
is that gross for sure.
You said it yourself, though, Gus, that it's like also there's the Shakespearean aspect of like, well, we can't sit next to an evil person. Like,
and he's a monster because he looks like that. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's.
But I mean, as people who've lived in New York and you do sit at a bench and somebody has no nose or something, you're like, oh, shit, I have to move.
Damn.
Yeah. Right. And you know what? You're right.
You're right.
I mean, that happened to me in Seattle at a bus stop like 3 months ago before the quarantine. And a dude just was taking off his nose and cleaning out his, he was like blowing out his sinus cavity. He had like a weird T-square of metal in his empty naval cavity. And it was horrifying.
And you got up and you moved?
No, you just sort of looked the other way. I mean, you can't really move.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's rough. That's rough.
I mean, you don't know what the right position is on that.
I mean, it depends, because like my whole thing is, if you're in New York City and somebody sits down next to you and they're missing a nose, my whole thing has a lot less to do with that they're missing a nose and the rest of this vague appearance about them, right? Like, because I immediately hear missing a nose, and I'm like, oh, okay, this person is probably I don't know.
Well, he sat next to me, but the bus stops in Seattle are small, and it was interesting.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the other thing about Glock too. It's like, you look at someone, you're like, how did a person come to that? Obviously, like, they were me at a certain point, because everyone is a little solipsistic. And then whatever horrors happened to them, like, for you to contemplate that, it's going to ruin your day, man. Like, you got shit to do. Yeah, also, all these people walking up to him, you know, like, they have places to be, you know.
And this time, I think there'd also be something of, like, what did this person do to deserve this or something like that, when you're looking at Glockta specifically, you know? Like,
oh, totally.
Yeah. Right. And just physical normality is... it's so basic. It's something we expect. And when you see somebody with just a full nose sheared off their face, you don't really know how to respond to it. It's there is a biological reaction of horror, of like, what the fuck is this?
True. True.
And I mean, if you can take the time to sit with yourself and overcome that initial like human
revulsion. Oh, of course. You'd be good. Then, you'd be a
you know,
good
you're
person.
Like, oh yeah, this is nothing and we're all just people and blah, blah, blah. But like the mental exercise, you know, like, it's a lot. So anyway, so these people walking up to Glockta, like they have made the calculation that they don't have the time to do that.
They don't have the time to do that. They're pulling a,
they haven't made the calculation. They're just swerving over to a semi-open bench and shocked by a bit of monstrosity.
Right. I mean, yeah, of course they're not in their making that calculation,
like,
but
it's a beautiful day. They're like going out there with their sweetheart, and then there's a monster.
Oh, this is a bit awkward. Let's go somewhere else. I won't want to make out around this thing. Make it feel bad because it can't make out with anyone. Which is true. Glockta doesn't make out with anyone.
He could though.
Oh yeah, he could get it. Oh yeah,
he could. You know what, Peter? You're right. Glockta could get it. All right. Mm-hmm. I want to go down on record. I'm saying that Glockta, he can get it.
Yeah, I think he can get it. In any case, it turns out he's not just sitting here just to feel bad for himself and do nothing, because the Archlector.
Okay, so Salt walks up to Glockta.
Right.
And essentially asks him, why the fuck did you bring me to this stupid bench? And Glockta explains to him everyone on the list has been murdered. And then Salt says, oh, interesting. Well, then there's a mole in the Inquisition.
Right.
And they're going to do a thing where they're essentially going to have Salt's secretary pass a note to K-Line.
That
Salem Ruse is still
alive. Well,
I'm surprised
how quickly Salt buys Glockta's story, which seems a little suspect.
That might come back.
He questions it for a second when he goes, well, go to the next person on the list. I really didn't expect you to need micromanagement. We did, Archlector. They're dead.
But Glockta sells him quick.
Oh,
On K-Line.
And it basically saying, like, well, you know, superiors aren't stupid. They got there for a reason. So we're going to lay a trap for him. Yeah, and the trap basically involved Ruse, who Glockta thought was in Angland, you know, already, or at least on the way there, but was kept in the House of Questions by Salt.
Right.
Which was like a cool move, right? Like, that was definitely something where Glockta was like, oh, he's smarter than
I thought
he was. Impressive. Yes. But yeah, they're just going to lay a trap for Ruse, basically say, so that, because the assassin is clearly going to go after him next.
Sure.
Right? So they're going to say, oh, we're going to let you go. So that basically Glockta and the boys can catch him. That's basically it. And they also say, don't come back to the House of Questions. You have to find another place to live, because we can't have people figuring this shit out.
He's his Inquisitor exempt, so he's trying to set up a separate base of operations for Glockta.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that's basically where we end up. It's sort of like, you know, this is what's going to happen next, and we're going to get there on this podcast.
I do like... he says, like, squeeze him until the pips squeak.
Yes.
I like that.
I actually looked that up.
Is that the derivation of pipsqueak?
Because
pips are...
like the pits.
The seeds.
The seeds. Yeah. Yeah, it comes from... I think it's like... it's during World War II. No, World War One. It's like a conservative British guy. Geddes. G-E-D-D-E-S. But he made a speech and basically said that we need to squeeze the Germans until the pips squeak. Whatever the fuck that means.
It's like if you're squeezing an orange till the seeds squeak together. Yeah. I remember the pips are from one of the first Sherlock Holmes stories where it's orange pips that they talk about a lot.
I mean, I appreciate that. I picked up on that too. And I was just like, I didn't think about it as thoroughly as you did. I was just like, oh, pips must be just like a guy.
Pips is going to get fucked up.
Yeah, this pips dude is... Sucks to be Pips. Oh, man. All right.
And then we get to a great chapter, like a really great chapter.
Glockta is watching the youths and he watches like a young dude spurn his lover and smile a little bit. And then Varus approaches him.
Oh, right. Varus comes up.
Yeah. And he wants to cajole Glockta into training or I guess doing a inspirational speech or an admonitional speech.
Tuzel's the best fighter, but he's like a terrible worker. He's the best fighter I've right. trained with since you, but he's an awful worker. Will you come inspire the lad? Glockta's pissed off at all just that Varus would come and talk to him now when he needs something, because Varus never talked to him when he came back after being
right. And as he said, he made his career as like the best fighter Varus ever trained, so he's a little bitter.
Yeah. But he does say, I'm going to come over there and when I get a second, I'm going to look at this guy, Giselle. And I'm excited about that if it happens, because I love Giselle.
They're going to love each other, Peter.
I really hope
that's the sex scene I'm talking about.
Oh, my God. I can't wait. I can't wait for it. So yeah, then we get to chapter 12,
yep.
An offer and a gift.
And a gift.
Which is Giselle, my man.
Tired and whiny.
Yeah, he's been training.
He's so tired. And the most
Does
whiny.
Does 4 hours a day seem bad?
I wondered the same thing. And I thought,
a lot?
It must be 4 hours of intense training in addition to the shitty duties, like what he does in this, I'm guessing. So I'm guessing he's talking about
of like hardcore training. Oh my God. You do,
but that's what athletes do all the time. I mean, that's how athletes work.
I think that Giselle is lazy and rich though. Not like he doesn't want to be an athlete. He just wants to.
4 hours just does not seem like that much per day.
I had the same thought. I think he's doing other shit though. We see him in this chapter do another job, you know?
Right.
And so I sort of assumed that was him. Yeah, that it was like he has 8 hours of work or whatever pertaining to just being a captain in the army.
Okay. Does he get dressed before that though? Does he goes in there with his...
No, yeah, it did seem like, okay, let's get there. So he's training. And he's not really like focusing well, and he's getting beaten up by Varus constantly, and Varus like scolds him and basically says, "All right, well now you're gonna go swimming because you need to pay attention more. You need to get better." And he's pissed off about it and starts heading back to his house, where he runs into Lieutenant Caspa, who we met at a poker game.
Caspa,
yeah, who we met at a poker game, and who was described as rich and affable and stupid. If I'm not mistaken. And his cousin is there. Lady Aris?
Aris,
yeah.
Aris.
I mean, she's an heiress and her name is Aris.
And she
It's like Angland and England.
Yeah, I know.
She has a reputation for being one of the richest nobles. And a reputation for being beautiful too. But Giselle's like, oh, you're skinny and pale and boring. Which is interesting because everything he described about what Adi is lacking, you know.
It's a reflection of Adi.
Yeah, that he loves Adi.
I do like Giselle's interaction with her because he asks her what she thinks, she starts to talk about politics, and he knows nothing about politics. All he knows is that he pulled Bethod out of thin air to convince Adi that he knew about politics.
Right.
And now he is so disdainful of this person for doing exactly the same thing that he did.
No, like, it's a distinct echo of what he's been doing the whole time. Like, it is the relativism of hypocrisy.
As soon as you learn a thing, you can't imagine that anyone else wouldn't know it.
You just shit on the people just a tiny bit dumber than you. we've all done it.
That's an interesting point. Yes, we've all definitely done it. There's like an online saying that like the most annoying person is somebody one irony level below you. But I think that I actually thought this was an interesting scene, because seeing Giselle be tired and not interested in playing the game, because like any other time, if it weren't for Adi and if he weren't tired, he would see Lady Eris and he would be like going for it because he wants to be rich. He wants to increase his station. That's all Giselle wants. So it's interesting to see in this moment, the way he talks to Aris, the way he observes people with this kind of like condescending, judgmental air that just seems more general. He kind of feels like Glockta a little bit. That was definitely a thing I picked up, that like the way he talks and kind of like right. mocks and dismisses Lady Aris is like, holy shit, he's doing the same thing. He's like, I'm too good for this shit.
And totally unearned. Like, he has done no groundwork to be smarter than her or anybody. He's breaching protocol, as we see with her tender.
Oh, yeah. That oh, yeah, the handler does not like it.
Yeah, she's outraged.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not how, that's not the tete-a-tete that is acceptable, but it's funny.
It's what he chose to do. I kind of like it.
And then he runs into Jalenhorn.
Right.
Yes.
Who they do.
Well, as they're going into the round.
Lord's round. Yeah.
Lord's round. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do it like Jalenhorn is doing the, you called it, Peter, but they're bros. So Jalenhorn's like, oh my God, she's so fucking, she's got that, like that good stuff, bro.
She's so pale.
She's
so pale. And she's so rich.
Her eyes are so blue.
And whoever can fucking bag that is going to be rich as fuck, dude. What was her name again?
Well, that's not what he says.
But he does.
Giselle says that.
Well, Giselle reminds him that she's rich.
Really? I thought he got the whole thing.
That's exactly what he says.
That Giselle's like, and rich. That's his. I mean, Giselle comes off pretty good in this chapter.
Yeah, it's pretty. But I really like that Jalenhorn can't remember her name the whole right. time.
So they go to the Lord's Round, and it's really designed like Congress. On the left, we have Westport, which is the eastern continent, and then Angland and Sterickland to the right, and Middleland, which is like the central Europe.
Is Middleland what they would call it? They refer to something as like the true union. It was like
that's Middleland, yeah.
Oh, gotcha. But yeah, it's basically all of the a lot of like the nobles and a lot of the people there meeting for this open council, where it feels like this is where the actual government happens. And this was absolutely what Hoff, two chapters ago, was preparing for. And it opens up with this amazing character of the announcer.
Oh, Peter, I wrote him down as well, yes.
Who's just here to just milk the shit out of his job, which seems utterly unnecessary. He, like, announces, like, this session of the small council is open, you know, just... And everybody's angry about how long he takes. He interrupts people mid-sentence to announce who they are. And then, like, cutting them off with these long-ass titles. This guy just can't get enough of his job.
Time to shine.
Oh, it's a good gig. It's a good gig. I'd love to be this announcer. Whew. This is my new favorite character, is this guy and how much he pisses off Hoff. And now Hoff clearly, like, can't do anything about it. It says, like, yep, he can't do shit. It's funny. It's funny.
So we get the ambassador from Dagoska.
Dagoska, yeah.
Yeah, who is a
colonies,
he's a,
right? Sorry.
They are so Dagoska is it's kind of like Angland, but in reverse. Like in the south, it is the tip of the continent of Gurkle.
Right. The Empire of Gurkle, right? It's like the Gurkish Empire. Is that the emperor that tortured?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. The outpost of the Union in Gurkle. Is Dagoska. So he shows up, he's like, our land walls are failing, and also he's coughing the entire time because he's about to die. He's trying to get money out of Hoff, which obviously won't work. Everyone's yelling, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, he's coughing so badly that no one can hear him because they're all jeering when he's like, I need money. And it's like, money, no.
Some shouting here, like the clerk.
Yeah, I mean, they're all constantly shouting. That is the part, like the British Parliament. Nobody's quiet ever.
Yep, it was funny. This guy can't say anything. He's talking about how like the walls are in disrepair, and then Hoff fires back. You're supposed to pay for it with your own taxes, which I thought was interesting. That then he says like, and a levy on like the Spicers Guild or something. What does he imply? Like if they can't get the money, then maybe we need to take away the Spicers like a monopoly on trade in the area, something like that. I don't know. I thought that was potentially interesting, and it makes sense that Hoff, who hates these new younger guilds, would basically be like, if you can't get money from us. The Spicers need to pay up more.
The Dagoskin representative is doing a whole sorry speech about where they are, which Dagoska is, it's a peninsular empire. Mm-hmm. And it's utterly mismanaged. That's what we know. Like all the walls are breaking down.
Yeah. Yeah. And they also said that it was only a couple of years ago that they defeated the Gurkish, right? Which I guess I thought was interesting. That's what made me think like, oh, an emperor. Okay. This must be the emperor that fucked up Glotka and Glokta. And
thank you, Peter.
You're welcome. Yeah, I guess it's interesting to think that that war only ended a couple of years ago from what they were saying. So that implies, I guess, that it's only been a couple of years since Glokta came back.
Sure.
Is that true?
Well,
that seems
no,
wild.
I think like 10 years or so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Glokta says he came back 6 years ago, and it sounds like the war had ended like 2 years before that, because he's been in the Emperor's prisons for, what, two, three years?
For 2 years.
Two years, yeah, yeah. And then your boy, the announcer, comes back in and he does his big announcement of the king, and they drag the king in, who is this funny.
God, this was a great moment.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. He's essentially a gigantic fat idiot who is he's the monarch. He's the,
His face is dripping off his skull. Like,
right. Yeah. Right. He doesn't know where he is.
His neck is like, what do they describe? His like head has sunken into his neck because of how heavy the crown is.
Yeah.
They describe him as a large mountain swaying in the wind as he's like riding on this palanquin, surrounded by all of these like knights with this like purple cloaks and a sigil of office. It seems like basically the King's Guard. What do they call them? The
sigil.
Honor Knights?
Knights of the Body.
Knights of the Body. So it's like a bunch of Knights of the Body come in here as he's being held in, swaying, and then like blinking, turns to Hoff and is like, why am I here?
Right.
The Northmen, sir. Oh, right. What about them? it was good. It was a good moment. And that's when they let the Northmen in, right? Like Fenris the Feared and Wide-Eye Hansel.
Right.
Come in. And this was not to step back a little bit, but it was prefaced by how like nobody was more angry about guy from Dagoska was asking for money than the representatives from England, who are saying like, we're surrounded by Northmen all the time. Bethod has won all his wars and is talking about making war with the Union. We need more money. And, you know, Hoff is expecting good news because White-Eye Hansel said, hey, we're coming to bring you peace and a gift. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when they come in. The giant and White-Eye Hansel coming into the office, and everybody again sort of like freezing up a little bit at the giant here.
And go ahead. Yeah.
I also forgot that like Adi's here too, seeing all this. And like Giselle almost broke his
bit of a smile.
Yeah, he almost like fucked up and stopped standing at attention, which
he's supposed to be like completely stiff and in attention, and then he sees Adi and he like almost raises his hand to say hi to her. Like, I love that.
But no one important saw him fuck up. That's
no one would care if he did. Like, he's so convinced of his worth in this world and no one gives a shit. Like,
no one important saw it. So yeah, then Wide-Eye Hansel speaks. And he says like, we want peace everlasting. Yeah. And the king is like, peace is good, I love peace, but we need one thing in return. And Hoff sours at that because this one thing wasn't mentioned before, and the king goes, well then name it. And White-Eye Hansel says, oh no, that's when Fenris the Feared speaks.
Well, no, he says Angland, and then
Fenris the Feared says Angland afterwards.
I think so.
Yeah. So he says, you but have to name it. And then Fenris the Feared steps forward, takes off his cloak, and everyone in the hall loses their minds because he's just like emanating this fear. Like the guards fall over and people lose their, like everyone is trembling. And then he just screams in this insane voice, Angland!
You know, like it's like,
ugh. Pacey. Yeah. Like that really, that goes right through you.
Yeah, it really does. Like standing up and screaming England. It's also kind of cool that like White-Eye Hansel is like really good at talking to these people. And he's just described as the translator for Fenris.
Yes.
And so when Fenris just screams, yeah, England, what are all of the people writing in the books, taking notes? It's like all this neat lines, but they're all so freaked out by how big and scary giant man is, like writes England in a jagged script running like diagonally across the book.
Like when he takes off his robe, like you see his twitching, horrible face, like it's every emotion and his eyes are wide and closed at the same time. And Giselle looks at his face and he's like, oh, that's awful. But like what he's really bothered by, he's like, oh, look at those tattoos.
Yeah.
How gauche. You
know? That's so true. Oh, God, get these tattoos out of here. Yee. Oh, man.
I mean, Giselle has the good comeback in this whole thing. I mean, like,
he does. Oh,
he does. He does. We'll get there. That was a great moment. That's where I'm like, yeah, this is the best character. So White Eye Hansel says, like, but we offer you a gift. And he holds up this box and opens it, and it just has like a knife in it. And which they've been disarmed. This is like definitely a little fucked. And right. Fenris grabs the knife and like shoves it into his arm and starts bleeding and looking around. As Hansel says, like, the gift is, instead of a war, because we knew you wouldn't give us Angland, we will allow one of yours to fight one of ours instead. In the circle, as is the way of the Northmen. Because, yeah, everybody freaks out when, I should say, should step back a second and say, just like before, everybody's freaking out about this giant. Except Hoff, again, is like, no, you can't have England, you fucking idiot. Shut up. No, you can't. Like, even the king is, like, leaning back with his hands over his face. Like, one of the knights, like, falls over. Everybody's freaking out about this happening.
So, and Hoff is so still cinematic. Like, no, no. It's so cinematic. Yeah, it just, really like, is. The king, like, peeking through his fingers, you know. Oh, I love it.
Love that Hoff has it, though. He's like, no, you can't have this. And that's why Hansel says, well, okay, our gift is that fight in the circle. One person, Fenris versus whoever, and we'll see.
It's the challenge. It's like the big northern challenge, which I wonder what the history of that is.
Got to be something there.
I mean, it must, but I don't know.
So basically, Fenris takes this super cool knife and then stabs himself through the forearm. And screams. I think he screams again, England. And he basically says, like, who will challenge me? And people piss their pants, shit themselves, like guards fall over.
Yeah, he looks at the big guard and
he asks the biggest guard, will you fight me? And the guard like takes a step back and you know, whatever. And then he looks at another person, does the same thing, no one's answering him, and then we get to your boy, Giselle. Giselle almost hears himself speaking the words, but you know, Fenris yells at him like, will you fight me? And Giselle says, well, I'm terribly busy today, but maybe tomorrow.
And people laugh at this.
It like breaks, it cuts the tension, like, you know, people like you know, take a big old breath, and Giselle realizes like, oh fuck, what have I done?
But Fenris just you know, smiles through it all. He's not bothered, and then says
Tomorrow it is.
Yeah.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Tomorrow then.
And that's right when Hoff is like, no, there's not going to be any fighting. You don't get England, and there's not going to be any fighting, you fuckers. Get the fuck out of my living room. You all suck. You're all idiots. I really love Hoff. I love that, like,
Hoff is
you
good.
Meet him and he seems drunk and incompetent. And then eventually it's like, no, this person is supremely competent. He just doesn't want to waste the king's time. This is an embarrassment for everybody. They look like fools. Nothing good is coming of them. I love it.
No, absolutely not. And then they basically say, well, fuck you. We're going to come. And when we do, we're going to give you 3 signs. And Hoff says, you can send 3,000 signs, you know, whatever. And they walk out. And then the king, like the little cherry on top, looks to the Hoff and he's like, have the Northmen shown up yet?
Right.
Yeah,
that shit was good.
Yeah.
That was good.
Okay.
Oh man. So the king says, have the Northmen arrived yet? And then that brings us to the end of that chapter. And this, I think, is probably a pretty good place to end it. I mean, this was a lot of things happened. We got the introduction of the Northmen at the beginning. Then we actually have the Northmen showing back up.
And Peter, we are going to get to that sex scene. It's the next chapter, buddy.
Really excited. I'm starved for a sex scene for this one. You know, I feel like part of my belief system is that every scene can be and perhaps is a sex scene, but I'm arguing we didn't really get one of those in this one, you know. So I'm excited to see where we're going with the next one. Maybe we'll be there hot and ready like a Little Caesar's pizza with this bad boy right off the bat. Start of episode 3.
Hey guys, that was the end of our episode 3. Just to run down for anyone reading along, next week we will be covering chapter 13, The King of the Northmen, chapter 14, A Road Between Two Dentists, and chapter 15, Flatheads. See you then.